Podcast is kind of like a, it's like a radio show that's not on the radio. It's on the internet. Does that make sense?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. That's also like my mom. It makes it sound more confusing, doesn't it? It sounds like this.
Hey, what's going on? This is Alonzo, yo, Prodigy Towns and the Son of the Mule, and you're listening to the Rock Paper Podcast.
Rock Paper Podcast. Rock Paper Podcast. Rock, 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 rock Paper Podcast, y'all.
Hey, everybody. Shane Presley here, Rock Paper Podcast, coming to you from St. Louis, Missouri, hanging out with Alonzo Townsend.
What's going on, man?
Hey, man.
What's going on?
Thanks for having me over to your home here.
Thanks for bringing me on to the Rock Paper Podcast, yeah. Man. I'm proud to be a part of the show, man.
Oh, well, thanks, man.
Yeah,
I guess we do a little backstory first to get everybody caught up. But I just recently met you, maybe a couple months ago now.
Yeah.
I took a job working at Broadway Oyster Bar, and I met you down there. We've been getting to talk a little bit there, and then all this stuff, and so it's been becoming real nice. And then I scrolling through Facebook one day, and I saw your picture on an event for the National Blues Museum, and I'm like, "Hey, is that, is that Alonzo?"
And so I
get to researching, and I had no idea that your father was a musician and stuff. And so I said, "Hey, let's sit down and talk, man. Tell me about your dad and we'll, all you're involved in." And so I'm here, man.
Yeah, I've been flying on the radar on you for a little while.
Yeah. Well, and that, you know, and that's kind of the beauty of the show, man.
Mm-hmm.
Like. So anybody that's listening for the first time, I try to do a lot for St. Louis music with this show.
Mm-hmm.
I try to interview a lot of up-and-coming musicians and comedians and people and just kind of give them a platform to present themselves with music and everything else and interviews, get to know these people more as humans and not just, hey, here's our song and stuff. So I have these nice conversations with them. So doing that, like, I love talking about the music and getting to know more about the music, but as I've been doing this, like, I've networked out farther and farther. I've meeting people for the very first time on the mic.
Yeah.
But I'm, you know, as a fan, I'm always pushing myself to learn and educate myself more and digging a little deeper. So,
absolutely.
So, yeah, I mean, but that's a cool thing about St. Louis, man, is that we are essentially, in the grand scheme of things, a small town, but there's so much talent here, so many people, and I'm
like... Yeah. Well, I mean, this city has deep roots, brother.
Yeah.
That's one of the beautiful things about St. Louis is it's kind of like a diamond in a rough city by being so small and everyone... Well, I hate to even say that because a lot of people from the outside looking in on our city... considers it being a small city, small metro city, which you can somewhat paint it that, but at the same time, this small city has so much history, not only in just the entertainment aspect, but we have so much history here, and it's so rich.
Yeah.
And like you said, once you start digging, you'll find, you'll continue to dig, because you continue to find more and more gold, more and more gold. So that's one of the beautiful things about St. Louis, like you said, man, especially with the music scene here. It's very diverse. It's getting younger and younger, which is a good thing for us. The generation is starting to kind of latch on to exactly what this city was built upon and the principles and what it has to offer as being not such a major, major city. It's a beautiful city, though, to be around as far as it goes.
Definitely,
with arts and music. If you are a part of this music scene or this entertainment culture in any aspect, if you dig deep, you're going to be able to find more and more things to, unreserved taps. All
right.
It's amazing. So that makes me a little bit more proud of and appreciate not only my dad's gift to the city or my dad's role to the city, but the music itself.
So yeah, we mentioned your dad,
Henry Townsend. Yeah,
Henry so, Townsend.
Yeah, my dad is probably one of the most legendary Delta bluesmen, which is a lot. You know, them Delta blues is probably the richest part of the blues, or should I say American music in general.
Right.
So I'm proud to say that my dad was probably one of the pivotal players in that. He recorded every decade since 1929.
Yeah, that's crazy.
He was born in 1909 in Shelby, Mississippi. Ran away from home at the age of 9 because he was about to get a whooping. He about to get an ass whooping from his dad. My grandpa, and because they had a cane, he had one of those sugar canes or a cane back in the day, and he played a prank on his cousin and blew snuff out of one end into his cousin's face. So my dad was promised a whooping later on when his dad got back home, my grandpa, and my dad was very wise and at that age and 9 years old enough to know that that was going to be a promise that was going to be kept.
Sure, yeah.
Also, he was a very strict disciplinarian, my grandfather was, Alan Townsend. So not only did he know that promise was going to be kept, he knew that it was going to come with a hell of a repercussion.
Sure, man.
So to duck that whooping, he ran away from home and jumped on a train at 9 years old.
That's crazy.
And we're talking about in the early 1900s,
yeah,
which is unbelievable in itself. And he took that train and...
It's not like 9 year olds today that have iPhones and everything.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, even a 9 year old today, this generation couldn't last.
Right.
2 hours without their parents, let alone, you know, run away from home and say, I'm going to start life on my own. Forget this, you know.
Yeah.
That's one of the marvelous things about the story of my father is that, you know, that's like a movie quality script, but you can't script that. A kid run away from home at 9 years old because he didn't want to get a whooping.
Sure.
And he said, screw this, I'm on my own now. And he jumped on that train and took the train to Cairo. Cairo, Illinois was the first stop, which plays into a very huge and widely regarded song that my dad made, which was Cairo Blues. But that goes into the Ur as well, you know. And from that point, he never returned back home. He would see his parents again. They actually came up to Cairo with him. He was raised in Cairo. And, you know, he went on to St. Louis, but he never went back home from that. He always stayed on his own from that point forward.
So what do you find, like some kind of home or something? A children's home or something?
He was living on the streets on his own.
Yeah.
He started shoe shining, like he came up and just found odd jobs.
Yeah.
He started as a shoe shine boy. In the midst of being a shoe shine boy, he also became a lookout for a undercover club back in the day, which was during Prohibition days.
Yeah.
So he was a lookout for the boss man, and he ended up becoming from a shoe shine boy, being, you know, the door guy and saying when the law's coming through. So he had a big pivotal role in that, in addition, and that was here in the city once he finally got to St. Louis. I thought that's another part that you can't script. It sounded like you would be watching that in a movie somewhere.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
It's like a Harlem Nights or something, you know what I mean?
I'm trying to think, there's a movie, it's a Robert De Niro and
like Casino or something.
I don't know. Drawing a blank. But anyway, names escaping right now. But it was a young boy, and like he kind of gets in with the mafia kind of thing. You know,
similar
kind of thing. Like in this small town.
Absolutely. I mean, same retrospect. pretty much the same thing, except, you know, like I said, it was during the Prohibition days, so you're out here bootlegging liquor and, you know, and alcohol. So at a young age, you know, he was on that. He became, got tied up in that, which was, you know, good money at the same time. He knew what to do and what not to do. So, you know, it made him a man real quick, real fast.
Right.
In addition to that, he was enamored. He was enamored by the musical players of Lonnie Johnson. And that what made him want to kind of start picking up the guitar. And Walter Davis, he met, and Walter Davis is kind of who made him want to play piano. And he started picking up, learning those trades, and then he started playing music full time and started using that. And in addition to what he had going on as a side hustle, because I think that's one of the most important things that I tie into that storyline. He used to tell me that you have to find something that you don't clock in and out of, and something that no one can take away from you. And that's huge, because at them days, they were trying to take everything away from you. So that's what also motivated him to want to be a musician, because he could learn this and he can go on any street corner and start playing, which he did, you know, and collecting coins and getting money, getting paid like that. And that's something that doesn't have a boss.
Right.
You know, the guitar is your boss.
Yeah.
You know? So can't no one tell you to stop doing, stop playing that, stop playing that. That was his moneymaker. So that was motivating him to become a musician. And, you know, once he picked that up, he picked it up pretty proficiently and then started getting known around town here in the city. And that led to him starting to get re-recorded a lot more. He was one of the musicians that were recorded for the Liberia Congress with Alan Lomax and his son. So those traditional Liberia Congress blues recordings, my dad's involved in that, and that kind of got the ball rolling for him. Then he went up to Grafton, Wisconsin, to Paramount Records. Paramount Records wanted to record him, and that's where he made his very first recording in 1929, which was Doctor Doctor and Jack of Diamonds, Georgia Rub for Paramount Records. It was an old Cheer Factory. And that's so important, because that primary location, that recording, that happening, that event in his life would be the full circle of his career, because he had never been, he started there in 1929 with his first recording, never have been back until 2006. And that's where he passed away at.
Yeah.
You know, my dad passed away in Grafton, Wisconsin, for the very first Paramount Blues Festival. They did a Walk of Fame up there, so he was one of the first recipients on there, because he was one of the very first recordings of Paramount Records. And got up there, and, you know, long story short, it was the first time he's ever been back there since 1929, and that was the last, and his career pretty much kind of completed itself. Mm. He was going up there to perform, never got a chance to perform at the festival either. But made it back up there to the same place, and that's where his career went.
Yeah.
You know, in. So it's amazing, though, what he accomplished throughout, you know, that time frame.
Yeah.
He started his career before a Grammy ever existed, and he would end up receiving one later on, posthumously, in 2008. But that's one of the coolest things about that Grammy. When I look at it every day, when I come home, I got to sit right over there in the corner, and I come home and I look at it every day. And that's the coolest thing about it, is because it's not even just a Grammy. I just know that it's my dad's, and when he started his love, his passion, that thing didn't even exist.
Right.
You know, he outlived that. And a lot of his contemporaries.
Right. You ever watch that movie, Old Brother Ward, though?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. George Clooney.
Yeah. I just, when you're telling the story about, you know, beginning in 1929 and stuff, like, there's that scene where, you know, he meets the guy at Crossroads and stuff, and he was like, yeah, they got this man to pay him, you know, to sing into a can and stuff, and I just imagine, like, you know, that you know, something like that for your dad, like, you know, getting into the early stages of recording, because in 1929 it was, you know, very early on that stuff. So
absolutely. And then at that 1929, you got to think about, we're talking about one of the biggest American history tragedies at the same time with the Great Depression.
Right.
So, you know, you're talking about an era where a lot of people, I mean, literally scratch and claw to get through the day.
Yeah.
Let alone be out here getting recorded and trying to do things like that. That's another huge thing about my dad I always think about is when I be trying to whine and bitch about what's going on, I'm like, this dude's lived through some of the worst things in American history and survived and thrived. You know, it's one thing to survive. It's a whole nother thing to thrive throughout those eras. And he was able to thrive. I mean, it was a time in those, in that time frame, I believe it was like the late 50s or I want to say either the late 50s or late 60s and 70s into that time frame. My dad wasn't even recording. Had stopped recording for a while or had stopped playing. He kept recording but stopped playing out so much. And he picked up a job as a bill collector for IMC, Independent Merchants Corporation, down on Grand. The building's actually still there. And as a kid, I had to be like 6 or 7, maybe 8 years old in those time frames. That place stayed or was actually still open. And he took me down there a couple of times. It was these two old lady, and she had all these rings on, man, snow white blind hair, and she remembered my dad, and that's the place that she bill collected for. And if you think about then, in that era, bill collectors aren't like they are now. They weren't calling you on the phone. That was their way. Now, that's their way of hunting you down. Back then, they would show up at your house with a .38
right,
talking about, hey, you got this money for what you owe, you know, and my dad's doing one of the most dangerous jobs in the world, which at that time was bill collecting. I mean, he went through and did all these little odd jobs and stopped playing for a while and was able to jump back in the 70s and started, and that's when the European craze started as far as the blues go, where Europe and the UK and all those places in Amsterdam and Switzerland were in love with people like Muddy Waters and Howlin', and they were getting them to come over there. That music was being rebirthed, and my dad, and they were coming over there and playing at these festivals and being reborn and having the passion kind of be rebirthed in them. That ties into it. I think it's just some of all these different eras had all these different things going on in them, and to be able to survive and thrive through that, it definitely makes me the person I am today, because I got this never quit, never give up type mentality because of those things right there that I went through. Literally, it sounds as cliche as it sounds, I have to give myself a reality check sometimes. I'm like, man, this dude went through so much and made it, and I'm sitting here talking about, I don't think I can. Like, come on, man.
Yeah.
So, it's a great benefit of knowing those things and being able to understand the legacy and the lineage and what it took to define that legacy along the way. You know.
Yeah, man. That's it's pretty incredible. Just everything, but then to record in every decade,
that's something that no other American blues artist or no other American artist, period, has been able or can say that. That's a huge milestone for my dad. He's recording every single decade since 1929, the longest recording artist in the U.S. on American music history.
Yeah,
no one.
That's nuts. I guess probably be a good point to plug this event coming up.
Nice. Yeah.
If anybody's unaware, St. Louis is now home of the National Blues Museum.
Yeah, man.
On Wash Ave.
Yeah, man.
And I have yet to make it down there. I've definitely been on the radar, and I'm extremely excited to make my way over there. It's just I've been working and doing the podcast and things, mm-hmm. and just haven't had it. But I'm definitely going to make a day for it here real soon.
It's amazing. It's an experience. I don't even call it a museum. I always tell people, I'm like, it's a whole experience because it's actually so hands on and so many things. They actually got a jug band room in there, dude, where you can go in there and play a washboard, play the spoons. So if you have not been, or if you want to take an awesome trip this summer, I would definitely look at a lot of the TripAdvisor sites and a lot of the getaways for the summer, and you're definitely going to see the National Blues Museum on those lists. Mm-hmm. They've been added to a lot of lists. There's a lot of great lists out there for the summer getaways, and they're on there, and for good reason. Yeah. So if you're looking for a place to come and visit this year, St. Louis would be ideal, and check out the National Blues Museum because it's quite an experience. And it touches every genre, from country to hip-hop to jazz. Every genre is touched in that museum, so that what makes it also a great experience. So you definitely got to
go there. That's the thing with the blues, man, is that... you might think like that's that, but and it doesn't, you know, the that's the blues, but the blues have affected being the fact that it's the, you know, the primitive recordings, the where everybody was influenced by it, you
absolutely
know? It's like it was all we had, and also it's like, but you can hear blues roots and country music and jazz and, mm-hmm. you know, whatever. I mean, all of it, it's all the, if you can, it all boils back down to the blues and stuff, mm-hmm. and like it's
absolutely. I was I'm working with these great group of guys that's trying to open up the Center for Artistic Development with Mike Battle, and we were meeting today talking about the blues in the schools programs and workshops, and that's exactly one of the things that I said. I was like, man, the genre, the blues being the birth father for so many and all of these genres almost that we listen to pretty much, makes it necessary to educate each generation, young and old, primarily for me young, about the blues. That way you can be a fully well-rounded artist if you choose to be. Should you choose this career, you have to identify with the blues, and a lot of our generation and younger. Luckily, it's starting to change with people like Marquise Knox and everybody out here. I'm thinking of him right now. His head's right on top of my. I can't think. Rattlesnake, Matthew Lesh.
Oh yeah.
With guys like that. You know, 16, 17, 18, 19, and 24 being actual performing torch bearers of the blues is making it more and more important for the guys that want to get in and want to be hip-hop artists, or if they want to be pop stars, that they understand the blues for certain, because the bluesmen were the first rappers. That's what rappers do now, is they sit and they talk about their emotions, mm-hmm. or they talk about, you know, the women or the cars. Well, if you think back, listen to a lot of these bluesmen, people like Chuck Berry, they talked about a Chevelle.
Yeah.
You know, they talked about the little girls. You know, people like my dad talking about she got a mean disposition.
Yeah.
So, or tears come rolling down. Why do you love me? Why do you love me? Or why do we love each other? So,
sure.
So, you know, all of these type of cars, women. So, you know, those are the same things. Cadillacs, you know.
Yeah.
If you think through it, all of these things are linked.
Sure.
Country most definitely has probably the hugest roots to the blues.
Yeah, it's got a little twang to it.
Mm-hmm, just got a little twang to it. So, I mean, that's what makes it so important. But, man, you hit the nail right on the head.
Yeah. So the National Blues Museum, I guess they invited you in to be a guest speaker this weekend.
Yeah, I'm on a pretty awesome panel this weekend. It's going to be with the son of Father Lou Times, Lou Father Times, who's a legendary DJ here, and I'll be on a panel with this with some amazing people.
Eric Ingram.
Yeah, Eric Luther Ingram.
Yeah,
yeah, some amazing people. It's a father and son's panel, and it's definitely about growing up, and not just blues, but growing up in the music industry with fathers that played or either was an influence to you in that form of their craft, which is, you know, music or DJing or whatnot.
Yeah.
But yeah, we're gonna, it's a talking panel from 2 to 5 on Saturday at the National Blues Museum. It's been highly receptive so far since they announced it, but they definitely called and asked me, and definitely had to absolutely accept. I love talking about my father. I love being able to talk about the legacy that that we have. And so I think it's going to be a good show. Be a good show.
I've told the story a little bit on here, but I recently, a year ago, I guess, something like that, I saw this guy, Kevin Smith, the filmmaker, at the pageant, did like a one-man show kind of thing, talking about some of the movies and telling some stories, and then he opened up to Q&A, and he was talking a lot about podcasting. And he also does a podcast, mostly, like, he does one called Fat Man on Batman, where he talks all about Batman stuff and, like, things like that. So, but he does a lot of recording with his friends and family and his mother, especially, because, but he was talking about how, like, he likes to record with the friends and family and capture these stories and these memories and stuff on the mic and preserve these things. You know, so that's a lot of why I want to do this and, like, and sit with yourself and get these stories about your dad and have these things preserved, you know, to where, and keep their memory going, you know, and stuff.
Absolutely.
I mean, so yeah, I mean, I appreciate you doing this, man. This is awesome. But yeah, that's, it's cool that, you know, even though he's gone, we can still keep, talking about him and carry on that memory.
So. Well, that's, it was definitely a no brainer, to come on and do the show. I love being able to discuss not only the legacy and the history of my dad, but it ties into what my role is now, which is the torchbearer. I'm very proud of that, and that is what my legacy is my father's legacy. So to be able to come on any platform and be able to not only talk about that, but, you know, talk about what I am physically being able to do to continue it and ensure it, it's a double-edged sword for me. I think this is the direction that we are definitely going in. I talk to people all the time about the digital age and the digital realm. I mean, we're so many years moved away from CDs being extinct.
Yeah.
We're obviously seeing it coming, though, but it's just a matter of time. I don't know when, but it's a matter of time. I mean, so many artists are getting smart, and that's what ties into the whole podcasting, because it's more accessible for people now. So it's on the go. It's on and off. It's rewind, play, pause.
Yeah.
So it goes with the change of everyone's daily lives in the digital age, with smartphones and whatnot. And that's the important. That's the thing that ties into the music. I tell people every time, all the time, that, man, you know, the artists are getting smarter and smarter, and they're starting to see that it benefits them releasing albums strictly through the internet, strictly through iTunes, strictly through, you know, Apple Music, strictly through Tidal, and they're breaking records and still being able to capitalize off of it. It kills the piracy apps aspect. It ties into digital advertising. I mean, you see people like Beyonce and Drake, you know, in the mainstream music world right now, that's doing it. And it's only a matter of time that everyone starts to understand and say, okay, well, here we go, here's at it, and be able to actually benefit off of it. And all it takes is tweaking out mechanical sales or physical sales and turn it into a digital royalty aspect with benefits for the artist. So that's what's gonna, that's what it hinges on, but that's the era we're going in, and that's what ties it to me and my dad too, because I have to make sure that with my dad being so, having so much in catalog from so many years back, that that be able to stand the test of time and move and transition easily or smoothly into the digital era that we're headed in. So that's also the huge part of me making sure that I continue that vibe and continue that, using every avenue that I can to not only continue to tell his story but to promote his music and continue to get these albums out as far in the digital realm, so that they know that it still continue to live on and stay in that test of time, because that's the, definitely the era we're going in.
Right.
And you're either going to have to get on or just get left.
Yeah. You know? I don't know. I think there, I think there's going to still be, there's always going to be room for other stuff. I mean, like, I know we definitely are in that digital, you know, way. I mean, everybody's on the iTunes and Spotify and all that, but but I mean, you got, I mean, even guys, we mentioned Marquise earlier. He's got his stuff on vinyl and stuff. Like, I mean, I love that about him, and that about that, a lot of the music that a lot of the people I support put their stuff on vinyl and keep a vinyl life. And I read something that, you know, like in 2015, they sold more vinyl than they had since like the 80s or whatever. Like, you know, it's been a long time. So it's cool to see that there's that resurgence in vinyl records, and so the CD might be phasing out, but I think it's going to be, I think there's still going to be people that appreciate vinyl and that, and just having that tangible product. You know, it's like, it's because you lose so much when it's the, you know, look at the album art, the liner notes, and all that. And like, you might get a JPEG file of it. Or something in there, but it's like, it's just so much cooler to hold on to and look at it. And
absolutely. And I think, and I was going to say, I think that's where DJs come in, as far as why DJs continue to be so vital. And record stores like Venice Vinyl, not even here locally, but just all over the country. That's why those things are so important, and we have to continue to support those. Those forms, man, to keep that alive, because I'm the same way. I'm a big fan. I'm a big old. I'm old soul, so I'm a big oldie. It takes me a while to kind of convert over to this new stuff. I swear, it's weird, but
I think that's why we get along so good, man.
Yeah, man. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the key, man. Because I'm not that. I'm not good. I'm not big on shiny and new.
Sure, you know? I try to embrace it, you know, like with this podcast and stuff. Like I said, but I mean, I'm definitely you know, roots, man. I've got a nice vinyl collection myself. I'm trying to go backwards, and I'm trying to rediscover stuff instead of trying to always, you know, I still love hearing anything new, but I'm trying to do my homework and learn things backwards too. So
most definitely.
But yeah, we're kind of talking, we sort of touched on it there a bit, but carrying on your father's legacy and things, and things you're getting involved in now on your own. We got a couple of things coming up this summer you're a part of. We got the Killer Blues coming up in June.
Yeah, and then Blues at the Oyster Bar.
And then Baby Blues Showcase. So let's talk about, so Killer Blues, you were telling me off mic, would be the summer at Broadway Oyster Bar, and that's what you guys, it's a fundraiser for Headstones?
Yeah,
man.
Yeah, Killer Blues do some extraordinary work. They've been around for a couple of years now, for a while, actually. And their mission is to raise money to buy headstones for blues artists, and whether they're famously known or maybe be under the radar to some people, they've raised some pretty good money for some pretty amazing artists. Like, last year was my first time actually physically doing anything with Killer Blues. We did a fundraiser at BB's, Jazz Blues and Soups, on 700 South Broadway. And that show was raising money for Headstone for Roosevelt Sykes, which is probably one of the most legendary piano barrel house blues players, let alone American music artists in the history that we have. And it's surprising that just with me saying that, that you would think he would already have a Headstone or whatnot. But that's the thing with the, so many of these blues artists, they're so legendary and they have so much history behind them, yet a lot of them didn't get what they truly deserved.
Sure.
Until either after they passed away or never even got what they truly or fully deserved. So that goes where they're buried, but they're buried without a headstone.
That's kind of like it's kind of like that. I think it's currently or going to be here soon, but I think Led Zeppelin's going back into court, and they're getting in trouble. They, you know, they did a lot of sampling and of songs from like Willie Dixon and stuff, and like and things like that. And like, you know, these guys at the time, you know, they, you know, they probably passed before they even knew the songs were out there on the radio and things and stuff like that, but.
It's so unfortunate, brother, because a lot of these artists, I'm not going to do this, so I'm not going to say that they deliberately, but a lot of artists get a lot of their material played after their past because a lot of the artists weren't given either they didn't know or they weren't given the opportunity to know how to copyright or how to protect their music, and so a lot of mainstays have either not been copyrighted or they've been picked up and copyrighted by another person and then start performing, or either, you know, it may be copyrighted and they wait till after the artist passes to actually start playing it, just because they know that they won't be hit as hard as if the artist was alive.
Sure.
But you know, that's a lot of artists. I mean, the Rolling Stones came over here and because they, for their love of Muddy Waters.
Yeah.
You know.
Yes. Yeah. That's kind of brings up. You know, we Prince just passed.
Yeah,
and then
rest
I read.
Rest his soul.
Yeah, I read that like I don't know, whatever, like 17 of the top 20 albums on iTunes sales this month or this week or something, you know, whatever it was. But like, you know, he sold a ton of material after his death, and like, you know, like everybody wanted to go and buy his stuff, and like just got, you know, more people may or you know, maybe younger people are just discovering it, you know, and things like that too, but. But it's kind of a shame that it takes somebody's death to fully appreciate what they put up, what they were.
That's absolutely. I mean, that's the same thing with Michael. When Michael Jackson died, man,
right?
You know, he was in debt for so long beforehand, and you know, and then after he passed, I mean, not only did he eclipse the debt, but you know, he probably made more money than he did. A lot. I mean, you know, he made more money then after he passed than he made when he was alive, and it's weird how that works. But no one really appreciates. No one fully appreciates your work or how precious or how much it meant to society or meant to the venue of music until you're gone.
Sure. I think that, I mean, not just in music. I mean, music's definitely the big, at least with music, though, that the legacy lives on. I mean, those recordings are always going to be there. So, but I think a lot of it is people, we always just kind of take for granted that those people are going to be there. You know,
right.
We don't expect them to, we kind of expect them to live forever at times. And then once they're gone, we're like, damn, you know, they're really gone. So
you finally take it for granted once it happens.
Man, that speaking of Michael though, man, you I'm sure you watched that. This Is It. That is one of the best concert
documentaries. That's one of the best concert docs I've seen. And to actually see the behind the scenes and how.
Yeah.
What impressed me the most about that movie was as you see the artists, how important it was for him to put on the very best show he could possibly do. Unfortunately, it didn't happen.
Yeah.
But you see how stickler he was and how strict as an artist he was. And I appreciate that out of any artist. It's weird. And I think it's because I grew up with my dad, and my dad was such a measuring stick in the house and outside of the house that he expected so much. And that's what I feel like any musical genius expects a lot. It's weird. It's weird. But if you really care about your music, you really care about your art form, you expect the best. You won't take no less than it. And then that kind of will transition to you at home. It's hard because my dad was super, I won't say he was strict, but my dad was super, he had this a measure stick, and man, we used to butt heads because we were so much alike. They called him the mule because he was stubborn, and that rubbed off on me generously because I used to want to find out on my own than listen. I think this with any kid though, but you know, some kids are harder than others with it. They have a stronger stench with it than other kids do. And I was one of those stronger stints that I smelt myself a lot. And I'm like, well, I'd rather figure it out on my own type thing. So, but that, I love that it happened like that because I was able to get the most, should I say, quote unquote, the most, whether it's good or bad, out of my dad and learn not only the easy way, but learn the hard way, the way that he was brought up. And I think that what made him such a measuring stick because of those things that he went through and him being on this earth and seeing so many things for so long. I mean, you don't make it to 96 on accident. You don't make it to 96 on accident.
Sure, man.
You know?
So, so coming out, I'm not sure the date on that, but...
I could pull it up in a minute, but it is an awesome event. They do some phenomenal work. I mean, I don't know any other organization right now that's doing stuff like that. I mean, that raise money and go out here for these families and try to put headstones. And not even, I mean, some of these artists still have their families around, and some of these artists don't have anyone around or anyone that we know of around, should I say.
Yeah.
And to go out and take it upon yourself and say, hey, this is our mission. We're going to put our headstone on almost any artist that we know that doesn't have one. And have amazing artists come around and do it and play for it and believe in the same thing. That's pretty cool.
Sure.
So it is actually going to be on June the 12th. This year, last year I did it with Tom Papa Ray. Like I said, we raised money for, me and him in the event, and we raised money for Roosevelt Sites headstone. So it's an amazing event. A lot of people come out. A lot of people donate. Like last year, we had Urban Chestnut donate beers to us for raffle auctions and silent auctions and whatnot. I mean, Shafley, Massage Lux. I mean, it's so many awesome people. I mean, we even had Oyster Bar donate last year. Joni's, Sauce on the Side, gift cards, all type of places. So it's amazing the type of support network that they have and people that dig in and do these things. But the biggest part is the musicians that want to that come aboard and believe in raising the money for it. We got Brian Curran and Eric McSpadden, Ethan Lightwin, and Chicken Town. If you know Ethan prides himself and built his career on Barrel House Piano Blues. Came all the way from New York City to St. Louis just because this is where his heroes and idols stomped at, and he wanted to do it the right way and came here to learn. So I have a lot of respect and love for Ethan. But the Keenan Brothers, the Bottoms Up Blues Band, John McVay, Big George Brock, who's, you know, one of the last of the legendary, and they're all playing, and it's all for a good cause. I mean, it's a $10 donation. It's the minimum donation at the door. We're doing raffles. We're doing auctions, all type of stuff to raise money for an awesome cause, and that's putting a final icing on the cake for a resting place of someone that meant a lot to not only the music scene, but to American music history.
Sure.
And it's, in general, so it's gonna be pretty cool.
And the other another thing we mentioned was the Baby Blues Showcase.
Yeah, Evo. Man.
Yes. And that's like...
That's in November.
November.
It's every November. It's usually always the last Sunday of November after Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. So that's the easiest way to know when it's coming up. It's always the last Sunday in November and Thanksgiving, right after Thanksgiving. That's an amazing show, too. It's near and dear to my heart. Every artist on the show is under the age of 30 years old. Every year, it gets younger and younger and better and better. I love doing the show. That's when I first actually, that's the birthing of my MC hosting, yeah. Hosting work was the Baby Blues Showcase. So I love doing the Baby Blues Showcase because it's definitely near and dear to my heart. It's the future of the blues, not only, but the future of the city and blues and musicians. So I love doing the event. I love seeing it get younger. The School of Rock usually, School of Rock's been doing it the last couple of years. Marquise Knox, of course. So it's a huge and it's a great event.
He's a bad man.
Marquise is probably one of the man. He calls himself the future of the blues, and he definitely is, man.
I love watching him play. He's I've been I don't know exactly when I first saw him, but I mean I've been following him for a couple of years now, and he's a lot of fun to watch, and it's just and to know, like, I mean, he's already been at it like 10 years or something like that.
Yeah, man.
Performing, and yep. But knowing that, you know, he's still just getting going. And it's it's exciting. Absolutely. To watch him grow.
He's 24 years old, man. And when I first met Marquise, he was 14. I was 16 years old. So that's, it's been about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Or so. And, he was the last student under my father. That my father took on his wing and mentored and played a little bit with. He took that boy on the road to Kansas City Blues Festival, and me and him shacked up in some hotel rooms, going out late, sneaking out the room late at night, messing with the swimming pools and looking for girls in Kansas City around our little hotel complex, man. Yeah. And I've had a lot of smoke-filled nights with Marquise, talking smack and smoking up, and I got a lot of love for that kid because he's done it the right way. He's taken his bumps and lumps as well. Definitely being the age that he is, and he's still learning as well, but. He's been around some of the best and some of the greatest, man, and that's not by accident. That doesn't happen by accident,
right. You
know. My dad, B.B. King, Robert Jr. Lockwood, Honey Boy Edwards, you know, stuff like that doesn't happen by accident. And so he's definitely has the torches and had the future and has the future in his hands. As it only gets better and better with him at age. A live show is an experience with him. And I feel like, you know, he's also still an untapped reserve because that's a man that can potentially reach all across the board.
Mm-hmm.
He can touch almost any other genre that he wants to as far as his guitar takes him. He can go mainstream. He can stay strictly in blues. He can touch. He can sing samples for hip-hop. That he has a lot of untapped potential and reserve that he has not yet to... get into, and that's the beautiful part about him. If you can see him now, see how great he is and how awesome the show is, let's imagine how seasoned and how great it'll hear in 5 more and 10 more years.
Oh yeah, for sure, you know? Yeah, it's exciting to think about. Mm-hmm. You were saying Jeremy got you got you started up in with the Baby Blues?
Yeah, I love Jeremy Siegelmoss, man. And I gotta give him a lot of respect. He won't take the spotlight, but he gets his hands dirty and he does a lot for this city and does a lot for this music scene. And he's very passionate and he's believed in it. And he is one of the founders of the Baby Blues Showcase. That's one of his first gifts that he gave to this city is to put on a show where you can find every single artist that you want to, that's not 30 years old, that's in his 20s, that's in his teens, whatever age he is, but he's not past 30, and can showcase them to you and say, this is the future of the city, this is the future sounds that you will hear, and give them an actual stage when they might have either not had one yet, or they're just starting to feel one.
Sure.
That's the beautiful part about it. And he was the one that was like, dude, you should MC. And I'm like, yeah, I don't know about this, you know. And then that might be like 4 years ago, and I'm like, I don't know. And it's weird that I say, because my dad used to put me on all type of stages all the time, from selling CDs and selling t-shirts and stuff for him in front of the stages at different blues festivals, Chicago blues festivals and all that, to actually being on stage and being like, I remember one time my dad played at the B.B. King Blues Club in New York City, and it was my first time ever going to New York City. I had to be like 11 years old, man. Mm-hmm. And I've always been a huge wrestling fan, because my mom Vernell Townsend, she was a huge Wrestling at the Chase fan, and she used to sing with my dad and stuff too, so it's pretty awesome. And so anyway, we went up to New York, and he was doing a show with Homesick James, Robert Jr. Lockwood, Honey Boy Edwards, and my dad. They called it the Delta Blues Quartel, and it was at the B.B. King Blues Club in New York City in Times Square. And along on the way to be going there, at that time, the WWF back then, they had a store in New York City right in Times Square too. And I'm like, Dad, you gotta take me in there, dude. Like, you gotta see it. So I went in there, man. He gets me a Rock shirt. I loved Rock at that time. That was my boy. And I had, I can't remember what that shirt said. Oh, it said, "Just bring it. Just bring it." And long story short, we get backstage to the B.B. King Blues Club. My dad getting ready to go on stage and everything. And the promoter, Michael James, he looks at me and he's like, "Alonzo, yeah, you should be my MC for the night." And I was 11 years old. And I was like, "What?" I'm like, "What's that? What do they do?" He's like, "I'm going to give you these cards, and you can go on stage. You're going to read them, and you're just going to introduce everybody." I'm like, I don't know, you know, I'm 11 years old, and I got this Just Bring It shirt on, and I wanted it so bad that it didn't fit me, because they didn't have my size. I was a skinny kid like I am now, skinny, always been skinny, can eat like a horse, but skinny as shit, but it didn't have my size, and I think it had to be a large at the time, 11 years old, so the shirt came to like my knees. So I go out on stage. Long story short, I end up doing it. My dad persuades me, "Yeah, son, I'm telling you, that's why I put you out there. On out there. So you can be a name to represent Townsend." I'm like, "Oh, I guess I'm doing it." So I go out on stage with these blue jeans, this long Just Bring It shirt on with the Rock on it, to my knees, and I've got these cue cards, and I'm emceeing, and I'm just reading what Michael James gives me, and it's like, "Please welcome Honey Boy Edwards," and the crowd just ate it up, you know, like, "Look at this little dude, man, he's awesome, man, look at this little dude." And it's the B.B. King Blue Club, so you know it's drinks, and they're drinking around. I'm 11 years old, so they're like, "Yeah, look at this, this is hilarious, this is awesome, this little kid's just out here, just hollering." So when Jeremy asked me, it was just like, I had not ever done that before since that 11-year-old thing. And it wasn't a bad experience. It was just like, I had stage fright and all that, of course, being a kid. But I had never done it enough to be like, "Oh, okay, you know." I've been in front of a lot of cameras with Dad and all that. But, you know, as far as just taking command of a stage, hadn't got to that point yet. For me. So Jeremy's like, "Yeah, you should go up there, Alonzo. You should MC. You and Kerry do it. I think you'd be awesome. So and so and so and so." I'm like, "Yeah, I don't know, buddy. I don't know. But he finally persuaded me, like, "Kerry's going to be up there with you. Kerry's going to guide you. Do it." I'm like, "Okay, I'll do it." First Baby Blue Showcase, I'm like, "Welcome to the Baby Blue Showcase, guys." You know, Kerry's all loud. I'm over here meek and timid, don't know what's going on.
Right.
And should I say full circle now, I did the Baby Blue Showcase last year. And I pretty much almost really basically did it by myself. I had Kerry there with me a little bit, but I pretty much When I got there, Jeremy was like, yep, Tony, you're off. This is your third time doing it, so you should be good.
Yeah, take the training wheels
off.
Yeah,
he took the training wheels off me. And and it was last November, and I'm like, I remember thinking to myself, like, welcome to the Baby Blue Showcase. You know, yeah. I'm just full throttle, full of energy, full of swag, feeling myself now. And Kerry, I get off the stage, and Kerry tells me, and Kerry's like, yeah, you don't need me anymore. I'm like, well, you were your teacher master. You know, right, so yeah. I owe so much to Jeremy and Kerry, both, because they seen me hosting shows and carrying my dad's legacy in that form. For a long time before I even did. So, no, they opened up the door for me when I started, to do this stuff and did it with the Baby Blues Showcase. And now I'm doing, the Killer Blues Headstone Project. And now I'm doing all these other different cool events, Paul for the Cause and meet the KDHS DJs and all that stuff. And it's amazing to be able to say that Jeremy was the reason that I was able to open that door. He cracked that door open and said, hey, you want to look inside? And I said, sure. And I closed the door behind me and haven't looked back since. So I have so much love and respect for Jeremy Siegel Moss and what he does. And he's the president of the St. Louis Blues Society now. So it's a new era. John May was finally retired after his long and illustrious hard work that he's done with it for so long. And now Jeremy's the president, and I say I call it a new era because it's a youth infusion. Everything's going to now what is the future instead of what the prior mission statement of the St. Louis Blues Society was, which was to honor and protect the current, the legends that we have. And now those legends have gone, the Oliver Sayings, the Johnny Johnsons, the Henry Townsends, the Benny Williams, Benny Smith, those guys are gone now. The Tommy Bankheads, and since those gone, and we only have Big George, and Boo Boo Davis now, as far as St. Louis and the blues scene, and Arthur Williams, even though he doesn't play anymore too much, but those are the only last links that we have left. So now the mission statement shifts, and it's okay. It's now to guide the future, and create, to forge this new way for the blues to continue to thrive, not only in this city, but to thrive in the city and pulse out throughout the roots that the blues highway has throughout this country. So he does great work. He does amazing work, and he's helped me. He's had a big hand in to the man that I am now, coming along within the last 10 years, definitely since my dad passed, starting this new forge. I definitely look at it. So I have a lot of love and respect for that man. And he's helped create some of these opportunities that I now have as far as, being on stage and doing these events and being the face of the youth of the St. Louis Blues.
Yeah. Have you ever considered playing, or is it something
new? I have. I played alto sax. I picked that up in middle school and wasn't the sharpest, but I was pretty good. Then I laid it down for a little while. Then I just actually bought me another alto sax a couple of months ago. I used one.
Yeah.
And I said I was going to play. I'm like, I'm going to pick this thing back up again. So it's been a thing. I realized also at the same time that it's not as important to me to be an artist as it used to be. I used to be really dead set on being an artist because I felt like that was the only way to carry on my father's legacy or be a part of the legacy. But then along the way, I realized that definitely not so. I can continue to tell the story. I can continue to be the mouth. I can continue to keep it visual in any way, shape, form, or fashion, and not necessarily have to be an artist. As great as it sounds to also be that and also do the same things that I'm doing, I also am secure and settled with that it's not necessary. Compared to how I used to feel, that it was necessary. My dad played guitar and piano. I know a little bit of piano. My dad, a Steinway, I think, piano. It just stayed at the house. And he wrote the notes, A, B, C, D, E, F, all the way down the key, all the way down the key, so I would learn. Mm-hmm. It worked for a while. The guitar, I could never stand still for or sit still. it was too much for me, so I could never be content. And that's exactly what it was. I could never sit still long enough to be like, okay. It was so tenuous to me. So I never picked up that part of it. I did pick up writing for my dad. My dad wrote a lot of music, a lot of songs, and I picked up writing lyrically songs for my dad. So they helped me forge a path in spoken word. I've done a couple of spoken word shows. I did one in Milk down in Cherokee. Went at Plush, so I found that to be another gateway, and I did, and I'm pretty good at it, so I was like, oh, nice. So
that's something that's always been important to me, and I have a huge passion for songwriting. Yeah. I wrote like school paper when I was in high school. Mm-hmm. And I wrote like a little bit of poem stuff, but I would like to, sit down and actually start trying to write more. But that's a lot of what I listen to, though, is a lot of singer-songwriters and things, and these people, they're storytellers, and it's just something I really, really enjoy.
Yeah.
But
always enjoy writing, too, brother, and it's always been a strong suit coming up through school for me, so it's something that kind of I already had somewhat of a gift, should I say, with it. Like, I was really good at it growing up, and then I was able to kind of tie it into music after I finally realized what my dad did, and how he wrote and all that. Sure. So it was able to make it a even more strong suit for me. So I enjoy writing a lot.
So did he record any of those songs you helped write?
No. I can't say no, because a lot of his songs would be created by me pissing them off.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna lie.
So you were the inspiration.
There's a lot of things that he would say to me when I used to get in trouble that I would hear him say later on in songs.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh man, there we go. I remember one time I was a kid and he recorded the 88 Blues CD down at the Shelton Concert Hall, and I had just got done getting in trouble like maybe 20 or 30 minutes before. I can't remember what the hell I did. Who knows with me. But I just got in trouble, and he had just said to me, something about this crew, you could be a cruel boy, and this world's a mean old world, and it'll crush you, it'll be crueler than you can ever be. And I must have got an attitude, because there's something about being cruel in the world. And then literally, he sung the same verse right into the very next song. Yeah. I'm sitting right there in the front row, and he said the same thing he just said to me in the song. And I was like, what the fuck? I was sitting there like, oh, really? I can definitely say that. And then I remember we actually sat down, and he was writing stuff, something down on a notepad, and I was helping him out with some verses later on as it got later in the 2004s and 2005s. As I got teenage years and started getting a little wiser. I actually sat down and kind of helped them burst things out, but I can't say that I can take credit for a song, but I can damn sure tell you I take credit for him for a motivation
right.
of the song.
I have this theory, especially like in country music, but I mean the blues are all, like I said, it's all there still too.
Yeah.
The same rules apply, but I have a theory, like if you hang around an old man long enough, like they all have these one-liners or whatever it is, and I'm like, man, that's a hook on a song right there. You can sell them like so, just like your dad saying. I mean, I'm sure he was full of his lines, and he'd put them in songs like that and stuff. But I was like, if you some guys don't realize that they're writing these songs every day. They tell you, and they're saying all these crazy things, talking to you and. And then you're like, man, I need to write that down.
Well, I find myself doing that a lot now.
Yeah.
I will write down. I used to text myself lyrics. I swear, I used to, like, I would be laying in the bed and I would be thinking about certain sentences and certain words, or I might be going through something and I would be thinking about a song. And I was like, man, that's a really good lyric I just said. And I would text it to myself.
Yeah.
It's so weird. And then sometimes I used to do the napkin thing. A lot of people do that all the time. They'll hurry up and write something down on a napkin. But yeah, I'm the same way. It's
a little tip. I had my friend Adam Ray on here a while back. Mm-hmm. He's a comic. Actually, now he's getting quite a bit of success. And he announced the other day. He announced it a while back, and we talked about it on the show. But he's going to be in the new Ghostbusters movie coming out.
Oh yeah, nice.
Well, so they made they made the announcement the other day though that he's actually the voice of Slimer. So, he'll be that part of the
that's
movie.
Pretty damn cool.
Yeah, yeah. But
that's the all female reboot, right?
Yeah.
That's gonna be pretty cool.
But what he does, and which I thought was a good idea, because say you lose your phone, or say you lose that piece of paper, or anything else. He said what he does is with jokes and things, he'll email them to himself. So at least it's so worst case, you ever lose your phone or anything else, it's on that email, and like that's always on a third party server. So I thought that was a good idea to always make sure you never lose, because he's like, you know, he learned the hard way. You save these notes in your phone or whatever, and you lose your phone, drop it in the toilet or whatever happens, and you're out, man. So
absolutely, man. It's a lot of tricks of the trades when it comes to writing that you'll find out along the way, and that you'll learn from. For sure, but it's always good to write to have a paper trail.
Yeah,
it never fails. I'm telling you.
Well, cool. I think we should wrap this thing up. You can come see Alonzo again this Saturday, 2 p.m. at the National Blues Museum in St. Louis, Missouri, on Washington Avenue.
Yeah, the Father and Sons panel discussion. It's going to be a good time. We're going to talk about a lot of great things. Some of the things I touched on and you know, here on the show, I'll be able to go a little bit more in depth. We're doing 3 hours, so it should be a pretty awesome event. So definitely come down and see me.
Yeah.
If you don't miss it, if you miss me there, you can come down and see me at the Broadway Oyster Bar.
Yeah.
I'm the restaurant manager down at the Broadway Oyster Bar, which is it's always a good time in there.
I was kind of segued in there when we were talking about Baby Blues, the under 30, but you were recently nominated for the 30 under 30 as a manager at Broadway Oyster Bar. So
Deluxe Magazine, I got nominated and ended up getting awarded back on April the 6th at a ceremony with 29 other amazing individuals that, I mean, they touch from anywhere from education to arts and music and to design to health. It's some amazing people that's on that list in all different aspects of life. And I was honored and blessed and humbled to be not only nominated but then chosen and be among those 30 with Deluxe Magazine. So it was Deluxe Magazine's Emerging 30 Under 30 Years Old. I was able to be on that list, and again, I'm humble as hell, and it's amazing to be on a list like that. And it was because the Broadway Oyster Bar and the National Blues Museum blues education programs that I was doing for Hip Hop for the Blues, that I still am doing, still involved in, and are near and dear to my heart. So I feel like I've just scratched the surface. So
sure, man.
Yeah, we ain't seen nothing yet. We got a lot of work to do, and
that's exactly how I just turned. I'll be 31 this summer, so nice. I feel like I'm still just getting started where I really want to be. Like this show, I'm hoping. I don't know where it's going to take me. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, I'm just along for the ride, having some fun.
Yeah,
but
It's been a nice ride so far.
Oh man, it's crazy the response I've already been able.
I've seen some of the guests and I heard some of the shows, and it's been a pretty nice ride so far.
It's awesome that I've been able to get, and the people that you know, to get the respect of these people that I admire so much that they're willing to come on my show and hang out for an hour or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's like, it just means the world to me. But knowing that, you know, that's just the beginning. Who knows where this thing will wind up. But it's exciting to think about the future and building not just for this, isn't just for me. I mean, I'm doing this for the city,
right,
for the artists and everybody else that, like, I mean, if I can help showcase, if I get one person to say, you know, say you listen, somebody listens to this episode because of you, and they go and start listening to some other episodes and discover, wow, I had no idea this person played, and they're in St. Louis, and I can go see them, you know, anytime. Well, you know, it's like they're right down the street. Like, yeah, you know, that's the whole idea. Like, hopefully people are going through and listening to some, you know, back at catalog episodes and rediscovering some.
But that's music. The love about it, man. That's the respect in it, man. That's one thing I know for sure is you can't buy respect, man. And when you get it, man, it means a lot, man. It's a lot of respect, you know, going on for you in the show that I've been seeing as well, man. So you definitely ain't doing nothing wrong. You definitely doing something right. So
thank you, sir.
I'm definitely a fan. I'm definitely a supporter. So and it was awesome to even come on and be a part of the show.
Yeah,
so
man,
I appreciate you inviting me on.
For sure.
Me sitting there and kick it with you for an hour, man.
Yeah, man, it's been great. I appreciate it. Like I said, and I'm honored to you know share your dad's you know legacy on the show with anybody that hasn't heard. Heard of him, but I would love to, you know, if you want, maybe put a song or two on the show also, if you have any you want to play or anything like that, we can also do that too.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, K-Row Blues, a lot of, you know, that's probably one of the most herald songs that my father recorded, but if you're not familiar or you kind of getting thirsty for some, definitely go online and, you know, Google Henry Townsend. You'll find a lot of the catalog with my father available on YouTube and Spotify. It's a book out that my dad wrote, A Blues Life. You can find that on Amazon as well. I got a lot of irons going on in the fire as well. We're still doing new re-releases. We just had an album come out in April. It was a original 1980 recording in Austria, over in Europe. Got that released through Wolf, and, you know, in good faith now. We got that CD actually going out in physical copies, and you can go online and order that. It's a great album too.
Yeah.
So we're continuing. I'm continuing to run with this torch. There's always something going on, man. You know, the Blues Museum actually just started selling my shirts that I made for my dad. So if you go down to the museum, you'll be able to go in the gift shop and actually purchase the Henry Townsend shirts. I actually got some new ones coming out tomorrow. I'm going over to talk with Lady tomorrow. So, I mean, we're still pumping this thing because it's very important. The legacy is always there. The history is always there. And I want to make sure that the history stands the test of time. So it's a lot going on. We just got to support the movement and just keep on running the race, man.
Definitely, man. Yeah. Yeah. So come out Saturday, grab one of those shirts Saturday, at 2 PM and at National Blues Museum.
Yeah. Down on Washington Ave, right across the street from the MX Theater.
Yeah.
I hope to see you there.
Yeah. And like I said, mark your calendar, June 12th, come out Killer Blues.
Killer Blues, Headstone Project. We're raising money for our amazing cause. Of course, we're putting the headstones on some of the most legendary blues artists' graves that unfortunately didn't get a chance to have one at the time. So it's an amazing cause. You'll get some great prizes. We do raffles. We do silent auctions. We got great music all day from some of St. Louis's finest artists. And
some of the best cooking in town.
Yeah, and I mean, come on. You got to come down and get you some Nola oysters, some char grilled. You know, some fried alligator. We got some of the greatest food in the city of St. Louis down there too, man. So, I mean, you're going to have some of the best all in one spot. Good music, good food.
Yeah. I was coming down to Oyster Bar all the time as a fan.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, I'm here enough. Might as well start getting paid to be here. So, mm-hmm. so I figured I'd get to start working there too. And it's been incredible. I've really thoroughly enjoyed my time there so far. And meeting the Johnsons and everybody that's a part of a Broadway Oyster
Bar. That's an amazing thing too, right there, man. I'm super proud to be a part of Broadway Oyster Bar. To be the restaurant manager there. I got a lot of love and respect for John Johnson and the Johnsons in a whole, because not only do they do things right as far as, you know, the Broadway Oyster Bar is concerned, but they have a lot of love and care in it, and that's hard to find in a lot of people and a lot of businesses in this day and age. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a corporate or commercial juggernaut, and people don't care, you know, and you get people that don't really care compared to being in an establishment like that we're fortunate to be in, and have people like John and Vicky and Brett and Blair to not only care enough and love their employees, but do whatever they can to help make sure that they succeed, mm-hmm. at the same time run a successful business. We are the 2015 restaurant, Missouri Restaurant of the Year, which is a huge statement in itself.
Yeah, we need some some
fireworks. we got to toot our own horn sometimes.
We don't have the budget for sound effects, but we'll make our own.
Hey, I got you. I can beatbox if you want.
Yeah, that's huge, man.
It's amazing. So to be a part of that ship and be a part of that family that we have, sure. that we're lucky enough to be a part of and have, is phenomenal. So I give a lot of love and a lot of thanks and appreciation to them. You know, when I got the Emerging 30 Under 30 Award, they put this big, huge purple banner right out front that you can see right now going to Courtney's Games right now with my name and, like, thank you. And people don't do that unless they love and respect you.
Sure.
And that means, and I say it meant, but I gotta say it means, because the banner's still up, and I'm not complaining about it at all. But the banner's still up, and that every time I look at that banner and it says, you know, congratulations, Deluxe Magazine's Emerging 30 on 30, Alonzo J. Townsend, it makes me appreciate the business and appreciate the relationship and the love and the respect even more.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me want to go in there and do 150% to 200% more. So I'm proud, and even seeing the J reminds me of seeing Henry J. Townsend, so it lets me know that I'm making my father proud. So it's a double-edged sword with that too. So we're pretty lucky, and I just had to give out that love and that appreciation and thanks to them, because they've helped me along the way as well too. And it's a big part of me being emerging is because of this place and the Broadway Oyster Bar and the family that we have. So you gotta come down there and support us. Come down there and see us, and after you eat dinner, have some delicious bread pudding. You will not be disappointed. So come on down.
Stick
man.
Around for some of the best live music 7 days a week then.
Yeah, so. Absolutely.
Yeah, well, all right, cool, brother. Well, I appreciate you doing this, man. It's been a ton of fun.
I appreciate you for allowing me to come on and talk stuff for an hour or two, man.
Yeah, no,
it's a pleasure to be a part of the Rock Paper Podcast, for sure, man.
Yeah.
You guys keep on supporting Shane, and keep checking out the Rock Paper Podcast.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Alonzo.
All right, man. Y'all take it easy.
will treat you kind and sweet. Get you ready and take you off your feet. Shoot you, knock you, pinch you and cut you too. Shoot you, knock you.
Rock Paper Podcast, y'all.